All right, so welcome everybody. Welcome to Gale Force, an intimate interview with a Nintendo legend, the Nintendo legend being Gale Tilton.
Thank you.
If you were here yesterday for Gale's chat with Frank Cifaldi, you got an entire overview of Gale's tenure at Nintendo, which began in 1983 and went all the way up through 2007.
Yes.
Would you like to give, I don't know, a general overview, a quick version summary for people that weren't here yesterday to catch them up to speed of what were you doing at Nintendo? What was your job there through the years?
Yeah, when I started at Nintendo, I was an advertising coordinator, and I was 26. I don't think I said that yesterday. And we didn't have any home console yet. That didn't happen until 85, so arcade games, that kind of thing, was what we were marketing. And then in 88, I was asked to start Nintendo Power, so moved out of strictly advertising and working on the magazine. And then in 1998, I got asked to lead the team to bring Pokemon out of Japan to the rest of the world. And then my last few years, as the brand group, we took over from our agency. We created a brand agency to license anything from t-shirts, bags, the kind of stuff that's being sold here as merch. And left Nintendo in 2007.
So, all right. I was not here for Frank's fireside chat, so pardon me if I repeat a lot of questions. But I did want to ask about when you started at Nintendo in 1983. The U.S. was in the middle of a recession. The console industry was in collapse. The arcade industry was starting to stagnate. And you step into this business in marketing. That seems very challenging. What was kind of, did you feel like when you got there, like I might be in over my head?
So first of all, I was young. I was 26. So I don't think, although I knew whether or not it was hard to get a job in advertising in Seattle, it seemed fun and exciting and very consumer directed. I went to work for an old boss that was at Britannia Sportswear, where I got into advertising. But I think that it was very tough in Seattle before companies like Starbucks and even Microsoft, Nintendo. We aren't a city known for like consumer brands where you would do things like make TV commercials. You know, really, Boeing was the big industry. Not a very consumer-forward industry. So that's what made it exciting. And I like video games. I'm bad at Donkey Kong, but I like Pac-Man. And I keep telling everyone, I like Tapper. I was very excited to play it here. I'm bad at that also, but I like it, and Frogger. So anyway, I like video games. I like consumer advertising. And I like my old boss. So that was really the attraction.
Okay. Being here in Long Island, New York City, one of the first and most interesting things that you got to be a part of was rolling out the Nintendo Entertainment System, which was first sold in New York City, right? Could you regale us with stories of that time and the role that you played and any memories you have of the NES launch?
Yes, so by 1985, of course, the Famicom was already happening in Japan, and the industry had crashed. Everything was on clearance. I don't think anyone, maybe Atari was between the 5200 and the 7800, but most people were not introducing new consoles, and certainly the retailers were not interested in carrying consoles. But so in 1985, knowing that, you know, our system did more closely approach the arcade experience. That's always what people were promising. It was just like the arcade. So more closely, and felt it was making a leap. That's when the decision to make a trial, if you can make it in New York, you can make it anywhere, that sentiment. And at the time, because even in the U.S., you could do a target market where other people were not learning about anything about your product. Now, with the internet and global communication, that's not the case. But at the time, you really could isolate to a single market. Your TV commercials, your radio stuff, your PR, it wasn't going to go really far beyond where you were. So choosing the New York market, choosing things, I'm going to make it shorter than I spent 20 minutes on this yesterday, I think, but choosing PR firm and advertising agency in New York. We had a task force that came and went around to stores that maybe don't exist anymore here, but like Crazy Eddie and I think it's called The Wiz. There was F.A.O. Schwartz and those kinds of retailers that we had the product in. So my job, which was really all of what I think now we refer to as MarCom, so the types of communication that reached usually consumers, a little bit of retailer trade, but it meant I was trying to get people to write stories, and that was a big challenge. No one wanted to write about video games at that time, and so everyone who knows who Howard Phillips is, he would help me sometimes in marketing, and he said that I should throw Rob off the Brooklyn Bridge, and that would be how I was going to get a story. So anyway, we went to did a mall tour to like five different malls. That I think the one on Long Island, is it Green Acres? Green something?
Yeah, Valley Stream.
Valley Stream. Okay, so Green we did that one. The lady that was running the mall there was not happy about our video game presence. So whether it was going out to mall tours, it was trying to get PR, it was helping the ad agency with packaging and packaging, making sure the materials were all localized properly, the names of the games were localized properly, and doing, attending TV shoots. Like, it was a matter, even naming everything, naming Rob, the robotic operator, naming the Nintendo Entertainment System, how the logo would appear, what colors it would appear in. You know, all those things, that was like such a mad dash. We didn't get here for the task force until June or July for a September launch. It was crazy. Hmm. But really fun. I was probably in New York for that, for the better part of 6 months to work directly with the agency. Was in Manhattan and I was in a hotel. I could look out my window sometimes if I was on the right floor and see the office of the people that I was working with to wave at me. But that was it.
Great.
So was kind of secrecy a key component of this rollout, you know, trying to keep it localized to awareness within the New York area? So we were reaching out to press just within the New York area mainly?
Yeah, it was really very much localized, local papers, or even, you know, what your real dream hit would be to get a little blurb on a TV thing. In order to get attention, another thing we did is we hired two New York Mets, Ron Darling and Mookie Wilson, who would alternate coming to our thing and play NES baseball against the people who had come. And I think Mookie was more excited than Ron Darling to be there. And he had a son named Preston, who I think ultimately played baseball. And he was very excited to be there. You know, he was probably 10, and he's running around playing video games while his dad's, you know, having to stand on the platform and sign autographs and et cetera. So
would you say there was good energy surrounding, you know, the reception of the NES and those test market trials?
So from an adult perspective or a B2B, business-to-business perspective, and things like the press, no, it was a terrible reception. No one wanted to spend another $150 on a video game system and invest in more software that their kids would only play for a short time. So really, the reception was cool, and honestly, I have read things with at my level of, although I reported to the vice president of sales and marketing, so there was nobody else directly in my job, from my understanding, the executives were still worried that the sales results weren't instantly strong.
But it did well enough that you decided to expand into other test markets as we got into 1986?
I think that, you know, before we even were well into New York, we had already made the decision to go to L.A.
Okay.
And we had two good distributors that were working with the that were working with all of the retail stores. And so there's a lot of people that no one hears about. Like, I had a job that was very consumer facing, so it's fun for you guys to hear about it. But the people that it took, you know, strong people, there's a guy named Sam Borofsky. He was the distributor. He was the one, and his next, which was Randy Peretzman, they had to get these retailers to agree to carry our product. And, you know, if they had not been strong and successful, it wouldn't have gotten on the shelf. So many people that that it took to really make that happen. But we went to L.A. next, and in the spring, expanding nationally, there was a guy named Don Kingsborough who made the toy, the Teddy Ruxpin toy, and had started this company, Worlds of Wonder. And Don had been in the video game business, and our executives knew him. So he agreed that he wanted to be the master distributor of the NES in the United States, and that we would use his sales force to get it into retailers all over the country. So we went to a CES in 86 and presented, and I think I was probably the key presenter, having all the visuals. And they were so disrespectful, like they did not want to be involved in this product at all. And so Don Kingsborough got up and screamed at them in the meeting about how disrespectful they were. And I think over the next 4 or 5 years, we had this distributorship. And they may have felt that they overcame their disappointment in the midst of selling 30 million pieces of hardware. So anyway, that was also interesting how we moved forward.
You mentioned the response of the executive team. How hands-on were they with the planning and rollout of the initial NES test launch? Like, how much kind of oversight did they have into it, or did they pretty much leave it in your team's hands? I know today, like, corporations are extremely top-down, and, you know, no decision is left to chance, but it sounds like you had a pretty scrappy team that just kind of did what it could.
Yeah, you know, the executive team, so Mr. Arakawa, who was our president, and Howard Lincoln, who ultimately, they were kind of a side-by-side role, not at that time, but later. He was kind of legal and finance, et cetera. But Ron Judy, who was my boss, who actually is the person who brought Nintendo to the U.S., he is the one who bought the arcade games to first place in a tavern, I think owned by his brother-in-law or something. And he and his buddy, Al Stone, are the ones that brought Nintendo's video games and ultimately got bought out by Nintendo and became employees. So Ron Judy was my boss, and he wasn't sitting at the ad agency all that day every day or coming out to the mall tour with me, but, you know, I had a boss for sure. I don't want to say.
Was there a lot of oversight from the Japanese side of the company, or was it one of those cases where I know Mr. Arakawa and Mr. Yamauchi had a close relationship, a family relationship. So was there that level of trust where it was, you know, Nintendo of America is going to do what it does, and then, you know, NCL will kind of be hands off?
Yeah, I think I wasn't aware of when NCL would know or not. It required faxing, phone calls, or DHL packages. There was no ability to have visibility. We only had, I think, Mr. Arakawa and two other people, maybe three, that spoke Japanese. So we all didn't have any visibility. But I do remember one of the people that would liaise with me, you know, was always telling me, don't change very much, don't change very much. You know, if you have a instruction manual and it has things wrong, or it does not in proper English, it's like, you know, he never wanted me to to change anything. But Japan really, until way later, we were quite autonomous. And it did not require Japan's approval in order to give an approval to move forward. So for example, if you were in a meeting with an ad agency who's showing you an ad or showing you a package, and it seems that you want to go forward, we could just say that, yes, great, let's go. There was not multinational cooperation.
Did you find that changed over your tenure at Nintendo?
Yeah, it changed very much, especially once the internet became, so after 95 and when communication over the internet, I imagine now they can just send an email and push to translate it, and so the person who receives it gets it in their own language. So we didn't have visibility, so we didn't really communicate much with Japan directly. And, you know, the more global things became, the more Japan took on more oversight and responsibility of Nintendo of America and Europe. But sometimes they come to things like E3 or GDC, and it's more common now. But even that, it was very rare to see. And Mr. Yamauchi, I think in the time I was there, only came like two times to the U.S. and definitely didn't speak English or interface with anyone.
Well, I'm sitting here, everybody. It's a real delight for me to be sitting with Gail. I don't know if you guys know, I'm the editor of Nintendo Force magazine, which is the magazine that has picked up the torch for Nintendo Power after Nintendo Power ended at the end of 2012. So I have to take this opportunity sitting here with Gail to learn as much about Nintendo Power as possible. Who all remembers this? The original issue of Nintendo Power. So following the NES launch in the test market here in New York in 85, rolling out, expanding through 86, you started heading toward this moment. When you talked a little bit about this yesterday, but again, for people that weren't here yesterday, how did you arrive at the creation of Nintendo Power?
Yeah, maybe not taking too much time, but we were collecting names and addresses, and as a way of getting people to give us their name and address, we offered a free newsletter, which then blossomed into about 600,000 copies. It was eating up a lot of ad budget to spend it on these free newsletters, which made Mr. Arakawa say he wanted to start a subscription-based magazine to offset some or all of the cost. And so he brought in two different Japanese publishers who were making magazines in Japan. And we ended up choosing Tokuma Shoten as our co-publisher. So at the beginning, since the idea of Nintendo Power was to provide information that would not only let you choose the game that was right for you, but help you get through the game, finish the game, the type of maps and things that were made, that was something done in Japan. Ultimately, the group that did that, which was called Workhouse, they were contracted by Tokuma. They opened a U.S. office, and they continued to be the ones making the maps and that type of gaming information all the way through 2007. I don't know if Future... I didn't really look at Futures magazines. Did they have maps or that kind of information, or that just went away?
Not so much.
I feel like it's like some it stayed, others did go away, because like in the early 2000s, you have magazines like Game Informer that would show screenshots, but sometimes they would show like, you know, map certain areas, certain games, but not in full detail, explicit detail, like this masterpiece right here. Touch you.
Yeah. So, talking about when the magazine actually started, so Howard Phillips being the game master, he was instrumental in helping with anything to do with making sure that we understood the games. His job was to rate the games. There was a group. It varied how many people were in the group, but at that time it was the big three. And these three people would rate every game that came in. And so the game that rated the highest both got either the cover or the most number of pages. Mm-hmm. And especially if a game was going to be a two-parter for two issues, it would have a very high score. And if you guys have seen this whole score thing, there were things like sound, difficulty, graphics, etc. And there were six different things, and those six things made a spider web. And how round the spider web was how balanced, and certainly how far out the spokes. I think each spoke had five notches. And if it's like this, it's good here, but really crappy here, would not have a good score. And we showed that in a lot of different ways over the time that I was there. Sometimes it would be the power meter. It would just have we combined some of the things and have little bar charts.
Yeah.
One of the challenges, I'm kind of skipping ahead, but some of the things, so that, let me, I'll stop there on the rating system, but that's how we would work together and figure out what, we'd have an editorial meeting and Howard would also participate and figure out what games were going to be featured. So on the first issue, we had to go to Japan a couple times. They already had done the idea of the layout of the magazine. I think while we were there, so we came up with ideas like classified information to look like a covert envelope as a background. We, came up with the player's pulse would be more or less something coming from game counselors. And, we were working side by side. But if you look at that first issue and the crazy, crazy layouts, they were even crazier. They were so chaotic, and the color choices of a Japanese magazine or art team were much different. I would say green is the best example, like a very, what we might call like a pea green would be less appealing here than like a lime green or a Kelly green. So asking them to change almost everything, again, no computers, all just, typing things and pasting them on, it was a huge issue that I wasn't liking most things. And that's also when we came up with Howard and Nestor. And so we were spending all night in this hotel room going through all this stuff. So at one point when people got really annoyed with my changing everything, Howard made the comment, don't mind her, she's the dragon lady. And
no.
That has followed me through my career, and in sometimes not such a good thing, and being passionate about a lot of things and getting hot-headed, the dragon lady tag has followed me, especially in Japan. But we got through that first issue, kept refining, made a lot of changes. But there's all those things like the illustrations of the funny guy with the funny nose and the hair sticking out and, very, not something that we would have gotten if we had started with a Western art team. And honestly, wouldn't that have been sad that it didn't have that kind of really unique, fun, crazy character? And another thing that about working on the magazine and thinking about how it should look or feel was, although we knew that most, maybe the center point of our target was in the 14-year male age range, that we almost never talked about parents. We didn't talk about, school or that you were going to need permission. Like, it was written with respect to the reader being on the level of the writer. So it was really important that we didn't speak to the reader as though it was an adult-child relationship.
So just how big an investment, how big a risk was the sending out this first issue? I remember receiving my first issue of Nintendo Power for free You know, I'd gotten a few of the Fun Club newsletters, which were little, they were small, but this was a big, perfect bound, like good stock, full color, 100-page magazine that just showed up one afternoon in the mail and said, look at Super Mario Brothers 2, isn't it amazing? You know, you sent out how many copies of that first issue? A million?
Yeah, I think
more?
It's 3.3. We did it.
That's a huge outlier. But clearly it worked out for you because Nintendo Power continued and grew and evolved.
Yeah, I think, again, Mr. Arakawa believed that in Japan, magazines are extremely popular. Sometimes we think it's that way because of train culture or urban culture that they're, you know, sitting, thumbing through these things, comic magazines, etc. Mm-hmm. But he had two daughters, and he thought they like reading those magazines. They like paging through these things. And he just believed that the consumer would enjoy the magazine and that players or kids weren't any different. So he was very committed to this idea of magazines. Later, when you saw Nintendo Power had a lot of comics in it, that he also believed that comics and later Pokemon, those were all projects I worked on. And he really believed that, you know, things that are good entertainment work everywhere. So he, when things were like that, he was very willing to take the risk. Though I will say that when we had 600,000 newsletter subscribers, I don't think anyone thought it when we said, get your first issue free, that it was going to be 3.3 million. But the commitment was there. And I mentioned that yesterday that we converted to 1.3 million paid subscribers, which is unheard of. That's just crazy. So I can't believe sometimes when you're working in something like that, you just kind of take it in stride, like, yeah, of course, this great magazine that I participated in got all these subscribers. But it was a big deal.
Yeah, so you sent this cheerful, happy issue, number one, to 3.3 million people. You convinced 1.3 million of those people to pay you for the privilege of getting more issues in the mail. And then the next issue that those people got in the mail was this one. A little bit of a tone shift there. Would you care to comment?
Yeah, you know, the literal set where we did that with the fake Simon Belmont, we had, you know, the art team that we used, like, real like cow hearts and stuff like that in the photo. I did get advice that probably wasn't something we were going to be doing again. But anyway, that was very a little off key for sure. And when you think about Nintendo's position at that time about being so wholesome, and you know, there's the whole Mortal Kombat thing where you don't allow, you know, someone pulling the heart out of the body and holding it like a trophy, etc. I don't think anyone, yeah, they were not really going for this tone.
But it was Castlevania, so
it fit, but you know.
So I'm curious. You mentioned that you were, you know, you tried to write to the reader, to the audience, at their level, like with respect. How did you handle some of the messaging, like some of the business messaging and, you know, the challenges and logistics that sometimes popped up? For example, like the chip shortage that hit in 1987, 88. My very first issue of the Fun Club newsletter had Zelda 2 on the cover. And then it showed up again in the official Nintendo Player's Guide. And then again on the cover of a Nintendo Power issue. And then the game finally actually shipped, and I had it in my hands almost 2 years later. You know, there was a lot of, I think, frustration about that. That seems like it would have been something very tricky to kind of navigate in terms of talking to consumers.
Well, thank goodness we weren't the customer service department, so we didn't have to hear it too much. But that is true. You have, I don't know if it's too far down the line, but Robin Hood was another example where
we'll get there.
The game came out quite a bit later. So I think, you know, it is true that you would anticipate that something was coming. And it took about 3 months to go from the editorial meeting to you having it in the mail. So that time lag had a couple problems. One, of course, if there was a change in manufacturing or development, that it would be off slightly, or you know, that the newsworthiness, we talked, you can maybe mention what, how you are dealing with what kind of publication people are interested in when news now is instant. But being newsworthy, you know, became increasingly more different, not just timing of that specific thing, but also that the, I'm kind of losing my train of thought, but that the idea that if someone makes a change, you just can't be nimble.
Yeah, it's an interesting culture now to be producing a print magazine in the rapid-fire internet age. The rapid-fireness, of course, being Jeremy Parrish's fault for being so quick on the draw with his internet publishing at E3 years ago.
I see you were at the panel last night.
That's right. I'll throw you under the bus on
that
point.
Thank you.
So this being the fourth issue of Nintendo Power, Gail was a part of the Nintendo Power team for the first 100-plus issues. I've got all the cover arts of those issues that she worked on here in this very rudimentary slideshow. I just wanted to page through it and see if any of these images call to mind war stories, interesting anecdotes that she might want to share.
Well, you know, Ninja Gaiden, it's not a war story, but you know, parallax scrolling was a big innovation and also kind of then screws with the map thing. And story breaks in between levels is an innovation, and how you treat that and whether you like, I always like that kind of thing, you know, a little breather, a little story. And I will say also that first few issues, to some point, we had like a page that was just about general entertainment. Maybe that had nothing to do with a video game, just to do with contemporary culture, because that's me. I like that kind of thing anyway. It was such a bomb. No one wanted a page about New Kids on the Block or whatever.
Yeah. Go back to the early Nintendo Powers. You'll see a young Matt LeBlanc before Friends. Issue number 6. Yell out a woo or a holler if you see the first issue that you ever got in the mail as a kid.
That was mine, the Turtles one.
Turtles?
Wait.
Ninja Turtles was yours?
Yeah.
All right. She's
love Turtles.
Mega Man 2. You got a story about this one?
Well, only in that's my favorite cover. Yeah. I love that sculpt. The covers, which were done in the U.S.
No, I was going to ask, regarding this cover here and the very first one of Super Mario 2, do you know who did the freaking claymation? Because it's amazing.
So the claymation was done by a company. Now, I'm not going to remember their name at the moment, but they're out of Portland, and they were the most famous claymation company. They did a thing for California Raisins that was really popular.
Wow.
Yeah, I can't remember their name at the moment, but yes, it was them. And I had it in my office for a long time, and one time I was on a business trip, and I came back, and I knew that we were moving offices, and someone who didn't recognize the value destroyed the sculpt.
But you didn't recognize the value. It's claymation. How can you?
Yeah, they moved the thing and trashed the thing.
Some of these elements thankfully have survived. If anybody is familiar with the Art of Nintendo Power traveling exhibition, Stephen Reese.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and he has managed to approach a lot of people that were involved who still had some stuff. They coincidentally would find things that someone's going to have a garage sale and get rid of it, you know. But there was a company that did a few of these more hard form sculpt that we photographed. You could see like Ninja Gaiden, and there's a picture, those are photographic. But then also, if you go forward, well, even Turtles. So DuckTales, it's so funny. You asked me, Disney sent you assets to use. But no, in fact, we got permission to redraw characters even from Disney at that time. So Nintendo Power artwork needed to be original. So if we were doing something it was okay if, for example, Nintendo, Star Fox comes to mind, if they set aside a piece of art to offer us as the cover, but the art couldn't be offered anywhere else. So we didn't want GamePro or EGM, et cetera, to have the same piece of art that we had. Well,
the story that I always heard was that Disney sent you images of, like, Scrooge McDuck or later the Chip and Dale Rescue Rangers cover, but they were very specific about you couldn't enlarge the art, so you had to use it at the exact size that they had sent it to you. So let's see. We'll move ahead to Chip and Dale for a second here. Yeah. And so you had to compose this scene so that Chip and Dale and Fat Cat could appear at the sizes that Disney provided them to them. So is that true or no?
You know, I don't remember that specific case, but what I would remember and is true is that the proportionality of Chip and Dale to the Fat Cat is important to Disney.
Oh, okay.
That's or to us.
So that's actual size.
Yeah, that actual
so he,
size.
So he needed to be appearing in the background,
right,
as part of the composition.
Oh, probably not. You know, I think my recollection was more that we would send a sketch of what we were doing. Now, I'm not sure if they then finished the character, but yeah.
So you mentioned that imagery needed to be unique to Nintendo Power, and that does kind of bring to mind a question. It's a little bit of a sidebar, but at the time Nintendo Power launched, there were no video game magazines in America, aside from, you know, like the Computer Entertainer newsletter coming out of California, which was like 8 Xeroxed pages. As, you know, game magazines launched here and began to appear, like EGM, Game Players, Game Pro, etc., did you find that you needed to shift your editorial approach to kind of encompass a different style to kind of meet the challenge, or did you sort of stay the course with the editorial direction of Nintendo Power?
Yeah, I think that those magazines and ongoing magazines did not have that same mission of helping people to finish their games or to make sure that they knew which game to choose, because Nintendo wanted to make sure they always felt that they were getting value and that they or their gatekeepers, the parents, would spend money again on another game. So they didn't have that tied to their mission. I think their probably challenges were more things like timeliness, but they would do maybe more like some developer interviews or, you know, other things. Plus, Nintendo had a little bit of a burden that the licensees who were making products for our system, they, you know, we were revealing information on their behalf that we had to be accurate in what we were saying. And another thing we really had to worry about, like, if you can't say anything nice, don't say anything at all. So if we really didn't like something, a game was not good, it didn't get very much coverage, or if it just got a video short or with, like I said, a rating, we let the rating speak for itself. And I was thinking about this earlier. We tried several different ways of getting out of the idea that we couldn't be negative. And so for a while, I know that someone's going to correct me, but George Sinfield, George, and then someone else who I don't remember who it was, they gave a point counterpoint of their actual opinion about something beyond, underneath the rating review. And that we got only the tiniest bit edgier. So to say we only said nice things about everything, we often said nothing as a way of being negative, or we said complimentary things, let the rating speak for itself. And I think so. My answer is that other magazines didn't have to be nice if they didn't like something. They had multiple hardware platforms that they could cover. So it really is, as soon as Sega came into the picture, you know, they had more content, they had more freedom to say what they wanted negatively. And and they weren't really so focused on gameplay.
I want to follow a thread that you mentioned, and I know it's something that's important to you, but the fact that you say Nintendo Power, you know, one of its main missions was to help people finish games. And I can kind of speak for that myself. I was telling you earlier, Went back and did a video retrospective on Nintendo Power's coverage of Dragon Warrior, which, you know, at the time, I look back and think, I was a pretty smart kid. I beat Dragon Warrior, you know, without having played an RPG before. But then going back through the exhaustive coverage, I realize, oh, actually, I just, you know, followed this step by step. Yeah, it's just interesting that you say that was overtly, you know, a core value of Nintendo Power. Do you think that changed over time as well?
Not during my tenure, and Nintendo in other ways always wanted to make sure that people enjoyed or wouldn't get stuck in a game. I mean, game counseling, we had as many as, at some point, like 200 phone people, and they developed this system. It was called Elmo, but, you know, they had to have, again, keeping in mind, you didn't have a PC on your desk. You had, you know, maybe there was a mainframe computer that did something like billing, but this email, all this stuff of sharing of databases. So they actually created a database called Elmo, where how they were able to find all those answers when they answered the phone. And, you know, we just went to like extra extent that we were worried that there would be a video game crash because people wouldn't get their money worth when they, even at that time, spent $50. I think 44 might have been a common number for a game. And, you know, that parents are not just going to keep buying games. There's something in the business called the tie ratio. How many pieces of software are you selling per hardware? Keeping that number up. Mm-hmm. And, anyway, that, you know, it was just part of the initiatives mm-hmm. that Nintendo had in that regard. I feel like part of your question I didn't get to, but...
That's okay. I feel like that does really sort of set Nintendo's marketing and just entire approach of this era apart, because you look at Sega and Atari marketing, the back-of-the-box copy from games, and it's how hard they are. And I've been playing a lot of Master System games lately, and they really are hard. I feel like I can more easily get to the end of a lot of Nintendo games, even though they're challenging. It just feels like there are more, you know, like from a design level, that just seems to be something all across the company from that era.
Yeah, I mean, you know, obviously that Mr. Miyamoto fine-tuning of the arc of the progression of the game is, you know, that's just mastery. Like, what can we, you know, Mr. Miyamoto. I know what I was going to say is that the Kirby game actually was created intentionally to be a game that you would get to the finish. Yep. And so it was meant to be a little bit more accessible and easier, and that people who were having a hard time keeping up with where games were headed would be able to finish the game. So yep. That was another example of that.
Well, you shared a story with me earlier in the break room about the Batman issue, so I wanted to rewind here to Batman. This, coincidentally, was also the first issue that I ever got in the mail as a subscriber. But you said there was something interesting that happened, you know, when you're working with Hollywood celebrities for some of these covers, for some of these images.
Right.
Specifically this poster that came.
Yeah, so we made this poster with Michael Keaton as one of the first Batmans of the new era. And they made us redo it because they said that his jowls were too big. And and it was my understanding that he directly didn't approve it because of that. But when I look at this picture, it does look like he has a pudgy face. So I don't know if it changed it. Batman was a really good example of the idea that you could not get coverage in Nintendo Power if your game wasn't good. But there were ways you could enhance your coverage. So one would have been through a poster, although I'd say we just did the poster art. Another way was to give us a good prize in the magazine for a players' poll contest. And so that Warner Brothers gave us the Batmobile, like on, like crazy. So someone, I don't even know where it ended up, but like that's just craziness. Oh, we got all kinds of things, you know, certainly tickets to Super Bowls or tickets to, you know, for FIFA championships and going to race or meeting celebrities. Some kids went to meet Matt Groening, who completed their Simpsons poster for them. We not a Players Bowl contest, I don't think. Maybe a different kind. Not sure. But we had DJ Jazzy Jeff and the Fresh Prince. We went to the set. And I did go, again, being the celebrity hound that I am, that we went to the set. And they played games with the kids and, you know. So all these crazy things. I will tell you, when we ask on the Players Poll question, would you rather win trips and experiences or would you rather win stuff? Everybody preferred, it was strong in favor of stuff. But that wasn't strong in favor of what I thought was exciting. So we continued with our craziness. But that was one of the ways. They didn't start accepting paid advertising in Nintendo Power till a little bit later, 2008 or 9. You know, the subscription price didn't pay for the magazine and the marketing of the magazine fully. So looking for other revenue streams to try to balance it did become an issue. One of the main profit sources for publishing for us was really the player's guides. Is being something like $15. Yeah.
That was my first.
You got a player's guide.
Yep. Yeah. So you introduced the player's guides as part of the transition from being a bi-monthly publication to publishing a new issue every month.
Right. And then those issues, I think, were also available at retail. Usually retailers mm-hmm. didn't want to carry the monthly magazine. Publishing is so difficult. At that time and probably now, when you send magazines out to a retail store, at the end of the month, what they didn't sell, they were supposed to rip off all the covers and staple them together and count them up, and then they pay you for what they claim did sell. And it's a very, I don't know, say crooked business, like really tough to count. And Nintendo wasn't in that business of the way publishing worked, you know, and putting the magazines next to where video games are sold. Sometimes we'd have good luck with things like that with GameStop later or certainly with Players Guides, but it was tough. But anyway, doing something that focused on an individual game, ultimately everyone's least favorite, four-player extra. But, you know, that was a way of transitioning and then, of course, we just ended up doing it monthly and using the player's guides as a separate tool.
So then once things became monthly, how did that enhance your stress, accelerate? You mentioned flying back and forth multiple times to Japan for issues, and that was when you were producing a new issue once every 2 months. Now you're once every 4 weeks.
Yeah. You know, we did have a couple people. We would take turns. The editorial staff would take turns going to Japan. And we usually would go twice, once earlier to check and then once for kind of a final check before it was laid down into film. And, you know, it did create some issues because the woman that, her name was Pam Sather, she was doing a lot of these final editorial checks and she would do the press check. Well, when you go on a press check for a million magazines, like you stay up all night, they switch. This is too technical probably, but they have something, it's called a signature. You print like 16 pages at a time and then those all get folded up and bound in and then you cut it on the sides.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, but every time they put a new signature on the press, you have to come make sure that it's right or notice any last minute problems or whether the colors are turning out the way you want. So she would go to Japan and then she would go to the press check, and she certainly did ended up having someone who took themselves to the point of exhaustion. But I would normally go to Japan for something like a player's guide. I should have had you put this up here, but the Link to the Past player's guide, I'm super proud of. Again, the Gail Tilden wants breather space between the chapters.
Mm-hmm.
So the invention of why people are Hyrulean or Hylian and what their folklore dress looks like and how the images of the, I don't know if they really, it was Hyrule, but there's like temples and some other things. Like I participated directly in that issue. Mr. Miyamoto came to our Japanese partner was in Tokyo, so I didn't make that clear, not Kyoto. So I was not going anywhere near Nintendo when I went to Japan. I was in a different city. So he came and sat with us and made sure, you know, we worked through how all of these extra things about Zelda were going to be laid down into lore. And so that's really my favorite, my very favorite.
When you said Zelda, like the Zelda guide or the Zelda Link to the Past guide, that's immediately what I visualized was all those extra elements because they really did stand out at the time. And, you know, it stood apart from other games coverage you saw in that era.
Oh, and I named that game, too. The cleverness of Link to the Past.
You were sharing some fun stories about different things that you had named. Over the years.
Yeah, I named a few Pokemon, not very many, I can't remember, but the Poliwhirl, Poliwrath was his son's favorite character, so I got to say that I named it. And I also came up with the idea of Pallet Town was a word that Ms. Hiro Nakamura didn't, you know, in trying to come up with something that would embrace this concept, he didn't know that word, so.
You volunteered that.
I also named Howard was having a hard time with some power pad names, and so Short Order Explode. You can take that one to the thing.
Explode is a brilliant pun.
I'm telling you, punning, we lived a pun in Nintendo Power.
Well, we're into, since you were talking about A Link to the Past, I scrolled up into the Super Nintendo era. What was it like transitioning to a new home console and publishing this magazine and marketing, because Nintendo Power didn't exist for the NES launch, but it absolutely did exist and was firing on all cylinders whenever the Game Boy came out and then the Super Nintendo.
It was terrible. Like, you would want to cover all the new great games, knowing that the percent of your audience, did you guys experience this? The percent of your audience that owned the new hardware or would be able to enjoy these games or the review, the in-depth reviews. I mean, it's always there would be in-depth reviews on a game you didn't own, but the idea that the whole magazine is going to be focused on something that you didn't own, that was just horrible. But the games that came in at the tail end were often of a hardware system. They were often licensee games that weren't deemed as high of quality. And plus, can you imagine if you're the one who's doing the ratings, now you get to rate Super NES games. NES games aren't going to rate as high. So it was really challenging to try to keep enough content that the reader was getting something of value when we had moved on. So not my favorite any of the times that
That's
happened.
Always been an interesting juxtaposition to me, is that the Super Nintendo era began with Volume 28 of Nintendo Power. Here's Super Mario World. We're getting into this new exciting generation. Then Volume 29 comes out. Star Trek for NES.
Yeah, what month is that? Because we were going to talk about that.
Okay, let's see. What month was this? September? Okay.
September is, I wouldn't think quite as bad, but here's also a challenge. Everybody wants their games to come out fourth quarter so that they're for Christmas sales. They want to introduce a game when people are selling. Another period that's not so bad, June, when kids get out of school sometimes, parents would buy a present, even like at Father's Day. Sometimes Easter, depending on when Easter comes, people might get a gift at that time. But there are many times when it's like a down cycle. And so the types of titles that were coming in, and since Nintendo Power always focused on future games, not previous games, you were showing me when you have this problem, you did a retro thing.
Right.
So even in September, probably it's a little bit, you can imagine we start working on the September issue in June, and you just, you know, had E3 or CES, and this is, you know, the games that you have available. So I think that was like, I looked at some of those, even the first year of issues, there's some games you think, well, I don't even remember that game. And Blade.
Power Blade.
Power Blade.
Like, what game is that even? I don't even know. And that looks so... Yeah, it's bad. So nobody wants Power Blade. And there just must not have been anything else.
Poor Power Blade.
Something I've noticed is that it seems like Game Boy coverage was challenging for Nintendo Power, because if you look back to the early days of the Game Boy, coverage of those games is actually very scant. It's, you know, there's some great games there, like Super Mario Land and things like that, but it's very, very thin on the ground, I noticed. And I was wondering, like, what were the challenges there? Was it because of the screen, or was it just because the games are smaller? Or I'm curious about that.
Well, they're visually not exciting in print. So that's number one. I will say that I was not told very often what we were going to do, but one of the things I was told was that we were going to give 16 pages of coverage to Tetris. And that was no. And so
zoom all the way back.
We enhanced the Tetris coverage, if you recall it, was with these little clay tetrads that looked like Howard and Nestor, and they were scattered throughout. That was the imagery that made it more interesting. But I think primarily it just didn't look as exciting. I think, Super Mario Land also, I think the Zelda game that was not like a Zelda game with Kokoriko Village or whatever, that game probably got a pretty good depth mm-hmm. coverage. But mm-hmm. I think the Game Boy itself, when it comes to licensees, et cetera, you know, it's a fun device for people. Did things like Blackjack, I think a gambling series came out really early. Nintendo had a few really strong games, but also a lot of licensees games were of a different type mm-hmm. where it wasn't like Bosses and Levels.
Mm-hmm.
Here in your Tetris issue, you've got a bonus Dragon Warrior 36-page strategy guide, and Jeremy mentioned earlier the incredible amount of coverage that Dragon Warrior got, though Dragon Warrior never got to be the cover game. And so could you talk
Thank
a little
God.
Bit of... Oh, no. Oh, dear. Could you talk a little bit about games that never made the cover and... That have gone on, and like it's interesting that Dragon Warrior was never a Nintendo Power cover game. It's interesting that Earthbound was never a Nintendo Power cover game, though there was a lot of strategy guides made for Dragon Warrior. There was a strategy guide made for Earthbound, and a whole marketing campaign that went along with that.
Right. Earthbound's a separate story. I think that is really tough. Imagine that the games that do all come out in October, November, December, I wish if we find... something in about that time period, I'll bet we'll see that the subtitle games, we could probably find an example, are cover worthy. So if you're competing with Zelda, but you're a really good game, you're still not going to get the cover. It wasn't Nintendo only. It wasn't like I always had to put a Nintendo game on the cover. And in fact, in the first 20 or so issues, I think that were at one point more Capcom games on the cover than there were Nintendo games on the cover. So that wasn't it. It's just when it comes to really, really strong games, or if many came in the same 2 to 3 month period, you're going to find that it, which is difficult, and we didn't go back.
I've been tapped to say that we've already hit an hour, but
oh,
maybe
really?
We
I'm sorry.
Maybe we can push it a little bit further, because I did want to ask you around.
You're going to end on Virtual Boy, really?
I'm going from a print production perspective, because this issue shipped with a pair of 3D glasses to try to sell the experience of the Virtual Boy effect. What was that like?
I think first of all, shipping with anything just changes your ability to run something through the mail. That's terrible. And, VirtualBoy's a fail. Like, it was not that fun. It gave everybody a headache. It, you know, was so oddly, laser beam-ish. I don't know. Just it's not good. Yeah,
it's... Well, I always appreciated the effort of creating the screenshots in such a way that they would interact with the 3D glasses.
I would say we talked yesterday about Rob the Robot being, was a sales tool, not a, in the end it didn't have a play experience, which I don't think we really knew that it was going to be so laggy when we first saw it, or concepted that robots are cool. And Virtual Boy, I wouldn't say that it was just, like, it had a new technology, the Nintendo developers were interested in it, thinking it would have some software that other people would take on, and people, it's kind of like now, of course, when you wear a 3D headset, it's such an early generation of that type of concept that you were really seeing. It reminds me that now, does anybody go get their eyes checked and they make you hit the button on the little, that's what it is, right? That's Virtual Boy. So yeah. I think that it was a new technology, probably just one that didn't deserve to be marketed in this way.
If you want the complete history, check out Virtual Boy Works, written by Jeremy Parrish.
Nice. Really?
I did.
So what do you have to say about it?
I think it's a very interesting system that was dogged by a lot of unfortunate circumstances, and the games themselves are actually pretty good. It's just you have to kind of swim through all the difficulties to get there.
How often would you want to play it?
Oh, I wrote the book and I never want to touch it again.
There we go.
Just paging through the final few issues. This was interesting when you all did four different covers for Shadows of the Empire.
I would think that would have been... In January, we always tried to do a special cover. There was a black cover. There was an over cover. There was one that was like a gatefold opened up into a two-page thing. So doing four different covers. We did the spines that lined up, and there was a mistake to make a picture. So we were always would, in January, kick off with some kind of interesting little quirk. And I bet that the Star Wars may have been that.
And then you saw Nintendo Power through its 100th issue and a little bit beyond before making your transition to working on Pokemon.
Yeah, I was asked if I would, like I said, lead Pokemon, the team, to bring Pokemon out of Japan. And Nintendo of America had been spending a lot of time thinking about what we should do with Pokemon, but as the brand just heated up and heated up in Japan, the decision was made to gather up all the rights and to make sure that all the pieces could come to not just North America, but then to the rest of the world. So that team, again, wasn't all that large. Maybe at some point we had 10 or 12 people fielding things, and four kids had been our longtime licensing agency, and they had really a fledgling TV arm. And they were very anxious, as you can imagine, for Nintendo to take on Pokemon so that they could be our partner. And that was really, really exciting time, you can imagine, being involved with all those elements of Pokemon. But honestly, making Nintendo Power is really the pleasure of my life.
Well, that's a wonderful note to end on. Thank you so much, Gail, for taking the time
to
sit here.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you.
Thank you.